when you got to the studio, had you heard the song yet?
No. We weren't exactly delighted with what we heard, but, you know, it was, you know, it's like, here's the thing, here's the big concession. At the same time all this is happening, we're being sent contracts from Mercury Records. So we're thinking, well, this is great. We'll go along with this because we're actually getting a recording contract.
And our foot's in the door.
Yeah, and it's hey, we got to start here. We found it kind of funny because at that point we were still minors in the state of Minnesota, and our parents had to sign papers for probate court so that the contract could be legal with Mercury Records. So it was a real thing. I mean, we signed real recording contracts.
Well, and as much as we may not have liked the song, I mean, there was a bit of some ego going on here. Nothing against the bands in the Twin Cities. They were recording some very good music, but it was all done locally. There was no name recognition other than what was known locally about the record labels. And here we are with Mercury Records. And then we find out that, well, it's really not Mercury. It's a subsidiary of Mercury.
Their
on
sub-label,
Philips.
Yes.
Which wasn't a bad label, but kind of an interesting story on the B-side. Why don't you explain how the B-side came along?
Well,
what was the name of the B-side?
What do you want to be?
What do you want to be? Nothing in parentheses. And it was part of the contractual agreement with Mercury Records is that after the A-side, you could do anything you wanted on the B-side as long as it was taken from the Mercury catalog. And I don't know, we searched a long, long time, and it took us a long time to find one that...
'Cause they really didn't have a good pop catalog.
No, they really didn't. And,
you know, we weren't ready to do some singing non-material at that
point. And finally, we found one that Keith said, you know, I think I can make this work, and I'll sing it, and we'll see what we can do with it. And we were told to make it sound as close as we could to the original record, but we took a lot of liberties.
It's funny, I'll mention something, and I don't think I kept track of the website, but I found that song, not the Oscar Crunch song, but What Do You Want to Be by the Nickel Revolution on a European album.
A bootleg?
Yeah, yeah.
So the record comes out, Oscar Crunch, what happens to the record?
Well, before the record ever came out, it was pretty well pre-promoted. WDGY and KDWB were almost given that they were going to play this record because they did want to promote local talent. Mercury Records, with all of its subsidiaries, was important. And what happened is Pete and Dale promoted it well to the stations. Amos Heilitzer was involved because they were doing the distribution, so it was in all the Musicland stores. A funny story there is Pete told us, you guys got to go out and buy all the copies of the records in all the Musicland stores. So we're driving around, and you go in and you go, gee, I like this record so much, I'm going to take all that you have, go up to the register, shell out money. And we were stacking them up in boxes and would later give them away. But as I would later learn when I worked in the music industry, that's what churned the sales. And so the radio stations see that the record's selling, so they're going to play it more and everything like that. It's called goosing the system, and it happens today with books and not so much records anymore.
So the song is on the radio, Ouija and KDWB.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it was picks on both of the stations, and it became top 10 on both of the local stations.
And it was that classic thought of you're driving down the road and you hear yourself the first time on the car radio, and you pull over with a big grin on your face.
Churn it up.
Do you know the other part we had to do besides buy, we were told to pepper the phone calls a little bit into the route.
Yeah,
requesting,
that's right.
Requesting it.
Yeah, request your own song.
Hi, we'd like to hear Oscar Crunch.
But not too much.
I'm 13, I'm a girl. My name's Louie.
Is it true the song was played on Dick Clark's American Bandstand?
Yeah, it's a funny thing that happened. This is a time when American Bandstand would survey the nation. which I call one of the greatest times in the music industry, because there were what we call regional hits. And what was a hit in Minneapolis and what was a hit in Detroit and Memphis and Charleston, North Carolina, was not the same songs. And so the local and regional acts had an opportunity to get songs played. And so on American Bandstand, they did this feature going around to different areas of the country to find out what was hot in that part of the country. And for the week that they selected Minneapolis, Oscar Crunch was crunching it. So they played Oscar Crunch on American Bandstand. We were tipped off to the fact that that was going to happen. So we actually got to tune in to Dick Clark on a Saturday and hear our song. So that was pretty cool.
Did the kids on the show rate the record?
No, that was they didn't do rating the record on that. It was just played, and it was over as fast as it began.
Next on my notes, I have August 23, 1968, with the Nickel Revolution opening up a concert at the Minneapolis Armory with Tommy Boyce and Bobby Hart, the 1910 Fruit Gum Company, and supposedly Vanilla Fudge. What's the story?
Well, the Vanilla Fudge didn't show, and it was probably they didn't get their advance money. That's my guess in terms of how concerts happen or not happen. And many promoters are counting on the pre-sales to be strong enough to have that deposit money to give to certain acts. That didn't happen. And so consequently, we opened, and following us was Boyce and Hart, and then following Boyce and Hart was the 1910 Fruit Gum Company, and the 1910 Fruit Gum Company were saddled with telling the kids, the Vanilla Fudge aren't here. And
that's who everybody had obviously come to see.
Right. Explain to them what happened in terms of when they announced that the Vanilla Fudge weren't going to be there.
Well, we were damn glad we were off the stage, because it got ugly. It got ugly quick. You know, what can you say? These people had paid good money to come and see this. And I don't remember any type of effort to refund anybody's money.
Right, right.
I think the promoters at that point,
after we played, left.
Because they knew it was going to get bad.
But the 1910 Fruit Gum Company, and there's a newspaper article on it, said, we're going to give you a show. And it was interesting because for us, again, with that whole bubblegum thing and Oscar Crunch, but with the Fruit Gum Company, while they played bubblegum hits, they were a very, very good rock band, and they really did. They put on a very good show, and the place was jumping, and the kids loved it. And it was entirely different than their whole 1910 Fruit Gum Company. Interesting in that we got to play with them, I think, at least two more times. And so it was a chance to get to know them a little bit better. And they were great guys, a lot of fun.
So the fans who had shown up to see Vanilla Fudge were quite angry at first, but warmed up to the 1910 Fruit Gum Company as they started to play.
Right. Well, actually,
they
warmed up to the 1910 Fruit Gum Company because they were a good band, but they were still
mad.
Pretty mad that.
I mean, we were disappointed. For me personally, the Vanilla Fudge, it was just like, I love the organ, and just the big fat sound that they had. And it was one of those gigs that you look forward to.
Oh, and Tim Bogart, I mean, he's probably still one of the best bass players in the country.
The next day, the Minneapolis Tribune reported, a crowd of about 2,000 teenagers grew unruly, chanting, yelling obscenities, and stomping their feet when it was announced that the feature act at a pop concert, the Vanilla Fudge, would not appear.
And like I said, we were real glad we had come and gone.
Next on my notes, I have a concert in November 1968 with your band opening up for ? And the Mysterians at a concert hall in Champaign, Illinois.
And that was Scott's favorite band, as I recall.
I'm not sure you were calling that right.
Yeah. Dino Enterprises had booked that gig, and Question Mark and the Mysterians played. It was interesting. They had some very talented guys in the band, but Question Mark, the name was appropriate. That guy, that dude, was real questionable. And, you know, frankly, they weren't very good. And
he was awfully drunk.
We opened for them, and that was the highlight of the night. And then they
went
played
downhill after that.
Yeah,
and the only thing that went good for them is when they played Too Many Teardrops. That was the only thing they got a good response.
You're talking about 96 Tears. They're a big hit.
I'm singing the song, I guess.
Well, and they played it for an hour and a half.
You mentioned. Jerry, you mentioned Dino Enterprises. Where were they out of?
In Annapolis. That was a result of Candy Floss, the Mercury Records thing, and Dino Enterprises was a bigger national booking agency with very strong connections. And it, for us, it was a step up in terms of being booked. And of course, we at that point had to terminate with Central Booking. It was appropriate for where we were at that point in our career.
And you traveled to Cleveland, Ohio to be on a TV show?
Upbeat TV show. And we had to drive through the night from Illinois to get up into Cleveland. And I remember we actually checked into a hotel, but we only were there for like 2 hours because the TV show was filmed in the morning and we had to be to this television studio in Cleveland.
Did you lip sync your song?
Right.
Yeah.
And that would have been Oscar Crunch?
Oscar Crunch. That was kind of a funny experience because there's all these different bands that are going to play. You load in, obviously, just minimal equipment to set up. And they actually had us go to makeup, you know, so you're sitting there and you're getting makeup. For a bunch of young guys, that was quite an experience. And I remember the girl was using a pencil to color in my mustache, and I wanted to take her along with us for the rest of the trip. I was like, well, that looks cool. I look older now.
So this is really odd because your band has now become a psychedelic rock band.
Right, yeah.
And yet you have a bubblegum novelty hit song.
One.
Did people across the country think you were a bubblegum band?
That's a hard one. That's hard to answer. I mean,
probably out of curiosity, they'd come to see us because they'd hear the record on the radio, but it was like 1910 Fruit Gum Company. I mean, you'd come because you knew their song or songs, but you'd get there, and it was a whole different experience, and not a bad one in any way, because at that time we were playing some pretty good music. We were, you know, we'd been doing this for a while now. We were seasoned musicians. And when you're playing as often as we were playing, you know, you play the same song night after night, you get pretty good at it.
And you are playing Oscar Crunch live.
Right.
Not on
eventually.
The TV show.
Right,
not on the TV.
Right.
Not on the
TV. Eventually during the night we would play it, and we'd choose the timing of it. You know, sometimes we'd play it right away and then not touch it again, but other times the response would be good enough where we'd play it, or a couple times during the night.
Did Dino Enterprises attempt to book you with other bubblegum bands?
Yes.
I would say both. Mainly it was just to book the band and get good gigs. Following that morning there at the TV studios, we had to drive all the way to South Ohio to play at a college. And it was a crazy road trip because we didn't have enough time to get there, to get set up and everything. Louis, of course, drove like a maniac, and we made it. But it was a fast and furious trip down to Southern Ohio.
Do you remember the name of the group that we played with them a couple times, and one of the last times we were supposed to play with them, they never showed up. Or when there was another time when they showed up and they were completely blitzed out of their minds. Looking back on it, I believe it was probably because they were as disgusted as we were having to play bubblegum music, when really what they wanted to play was, you know, something a lot more progressive and a little more down to earth.
I understand 1968, 69 was a time when there were outdoor concerts held at Loring Park, Powderhorn Park and the West Bank here in town. What were these outdoor concerts like at that time?
Probably the best thing was that they were during the day. It was right. And it was outside, which was just a treat.
You know, the whole concept of Lovin's, but there was kind of a mean undercurrent to some of it too, because it was war protests and some of these people had really radical ideas about overthrowing the government, blowing up buildings, you know, and you're going, well, wait a minute, I don't quite agree to what you're talking about there. But they used bands to get people there. And when they would get people there, then they had a chance to spread their message, their political views, Students for Democratic Society. Again, just a lot of turmoil in the country going on. And so there was a peaceful part of this, and there was a real unruly, unpeaceful part of it going on at the same time. That was the very beginning of those outdoor things and bigger venues and outdoor concerts, so to speak, with multiple bands.
What is the next change in the lineup in the band?
Well, the way I remember it, we were going to Superior, Wisconsin, and there was something about a song that you had to know how to play or the band's going to get beat up. This led to Honey Bear not wanting to go to Superior, Wisconsin. So Keith Luhr found Mickey Larson at the CC Tap, and he sat in for that gig. That's when Mickey sat in. And shortly after that, I think, is when Ron exits the band.
I believe that's correct. And you know, Bear was off doing his thing. He wanted to go another direction, didn't he? He did, and he ended up with part ownership or maybe just an employee in a head shop, and he was living down on the West Bank, and he was into a lot of other things.
He was into a few other things.
And it was just kind of one of those eras when we were moving on where people were wearing out their welcomes.
And we found a guy that had been, through Keith, that had been playing at a bar that was really, Mickey was a total pure musician.
Yeah.
He was
very good blues keyboard player.
And he could sing.
And a good voice.
What do you recall about the London Inn in Eau Claire, Wisconsin?
That became our favorite place to play.
We got real close with the friends.
We had
the owners, I mean.
We had a good following there. We were just looking at an old contract in Scott's memorabilia where we played there for three straight nights.
And that happened more than once.
So it was fun in that we weren't at home, so we could do things that we... No.
Horseback riding, swimming.
Yeah, it gave us an opportunity to meet other people. So we had quite a few friends in Eau Claire.
Well, they always had a great turnout at this place.
It's just
and,
fun.
And it got to be where we almost thought of ourselves as the house band because we were playing there so much. And, you know, it was 90 miles down the road or something, so it wasn't that far. You'd get done at, 12:30, 1 o'clock, you'd be home by 3.
And then we'd have our days there, and we're out doing all sorts of fun stuff, and partying with the locals and things like that. So it was,
we even got a booking from the high school because of the London Inn.
Yeah.
Got to play the high school.
How long does Mickey Larson stay with the band?
Almost until the end, because it would be shortly after he left that we disbanded.
Was there another keyboard player after him?
Yeah, for less than one handful of gigs.
Bob Fisher
played keyboards for us.
And he was the younger brother of George Fisher, who was the DJ for KQRS, and he did the underground midnight hour. Started at midnight every night, and it was George Fisher that did that, and Bob Fisher.
So how long does this final version of Nickel Revolution last?
It's like Jerry said, not more than probably a handful.
Yeah, at the very beginning of 1970 is, here's what's going on. The student deferments have ended. Scott has a number that virtually says he's going to go into the service, And so he makes a decision that he's going to enlist in the Navy. At that point, I was married, had a daughter on the way, and it was I want to guess March of 1970, where we're playing our final gig at some
right, because at the end of March, I went off to California for boot camp.
There you go.
And Bob Fisher wanted me to carry the band on, but I just didn't have the heart.
Well, at that point also, you know, things had, if you look back on all the bands in the Twin Cities,
yes,
I'd guess that at least half of them had disbanded or were in the process of disbanding, and it pointed out that the fact that the music business was changing so rapidly, and in many ways not for the good.
Wasn't that also the time when a lot more bands were being formed overnight?
Oh yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's do a update here on what you guys are doing now. Kent, what are you up to these days?
Well, semi-retired, not necessarily by choice. I'm still freelancing, doing a handful of things. I've been freelancing ever since 1970s.
Okay, Scott.
Well, I live in Phoenix, Arizona. I have since about 2002. In anticipation of, we actually talked about some sort of band reunion years ago. And a couple of years ago, it really took on some significance. And I thought, you know, I still had my 1968 Fender Jazz Bass from our last gig. All my other equipment was gone, but I still had that. And I thought, you know, if we're going to do this, I probably ought to pull it out of the closet and dust it off. And consequently, ended up in we started a garage band in Phoenix. And a bunch of people my age and people that just wanted to do this for fun. And all of a sudden, we started playing, and we're having a good time.
What's the name of the band?
Outside of Normal. Still actively involved. My full-time job is a commercial developer. So, active life.
Jerry, what are you up to these days?
Well, these days, it's kind of interesting with the whole reunion thing. How I make my living is I work for Clear Channel Radio and advertising sales. I had spent 25 years in the record industry, so in a sense, I've always been around music, involved in some different things. But when this whole reunion thing came up, at first I didn't know if I really wanted to do it, in that I hadn't played the drums in 42 years or 41 years. And so a year ago, I began practicing, and through a series of things, found local blues jams, got involved with that, and the thing just kept morphing to the point where now I have the Nickel Blues Band in Orlando. Interestingly enough, I have four children. The last one at home is my 17-year-old. He's a guitar player, bass player, and a friend of his playing in the Nickel Blues Band with me. So it's three seniors. Two 17-year-old seniors and one not 17-year-old senior.
Yeah, Scott, we're going to kick his butt, aren't we, man?
Yes.
Louis, what are you up to these days?
Well, as far as the music part of it, I've just more gotten back into it. I should have a long time ago. Never sold my Les Paul guitar. I drive independently, delivering things. I still am in the jewelry business quietly, and I still do watchmaking. So I do a lot of different things.
Okay. Guys, thank you for taking the time to stop by Sunrise Sound tonight and give us the history of the Nickel Revolution.
Well, thank you for having
Thanks.
Us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much.
The preceding interview was recorded on August 28th, 2012 at Sunrise Sound in Rogers, Minnesota, and was produced by Denny Johnson and Tom Campbell. The copyright owner of this interview is MiniPaulMusic.com.
Oscar Crunch has gone to join the zoo.
Zoo, 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 zoo.
Yes, he's trying to be a kangaroo. He has tried to invent.